Now this evening, I don't intend to go through this routine or this procedure. I intend this evening, or at least will try this evening, a rather different approach. Some would say perhaps a rather unorthodox approach, but I don't think it's really so. Perhaps I might observe in passing that orthodoxy is a much abused word in modern Buddhism, and that if one wants to know perhaps what it really means, we can turn to the article which appears, or which has been appearing for 3 months in The Buddhist, on the meaning of orthodoxy, which is significantly subtitled A Protest. Now, nirvana is said to be the goal of Buddhism. Those of you who attended the talk on evolution, lower and higher, will remember that on our chart, nirvana was represented by the symbol for infinity at the end of the whole process of the higher evolution. So nirvana is commonly spoken of as the goal of Buddhism and the Buddhists, inasmuch as they are Buddhists. Now this is as though to say that there are different groups of people in the world, religiously, politically, culturally, and so on, different groups of people existing, and that they have so many different goals. Some after power, some after wealth, some after satisfactions of various kinds. So in the same way, there is in the world a group of people called Buddhists, practicing Buddhism, the teaching of the Buddha. And their particular goal is what they call nirvana. That's what they're trying to reach, what they're trying to realize. So we are therefore really concerned when we speak about nirvana with the idea of a goal. So let us try to understand what is meant by this idea or this conception of a goal to be attained or realized or achieved. And then try to understand to what extent this idea or this conception of a goal is applicable to nirvana. Now this rather different type of procedure obviously suggests a word of warning. We generally tend to think that words like goal and so on can be applied to nirvana as it were almost automatically. We tend to use terms rather loosely, without any really clear, any vivid idea of what they mean. And in particular, we're rather inclined to transfer terms and expressions derived from our mundane experience to our spiritual experiences, even to the transcendental itself. And of course, we very often find that they don't quite fit. Sometimes even that they don't fit at all. So with this in mind, let's get back to the idea of a goal. A goal means an objective. It's something we have to strive either to be or to have. We can even say that these two, being and having, are the same. Because we can say having is a sort of vicarious being. A goal is something that we want to be. Suppose, for instance, our goal is wealth. Well, we can say that our goal is to possess wealth, or we can say that our goal is to be wealthy. But obviously the possessing, the having, is reducible to the being, the existing. Now, a very important point which arises here is this, that we can want to be only that which we are not. Obviously, we don't want to have or to be that which we already are, that which we already have. We want to be that which we are not. And this suggests, quite obviously, that we're dissatisfied with what we are. If we are not dissatisfied with what we are, we shall never strive to be that which we are not. Suppose, just by way of example, our goal, as I just mentioned, happens to be money, wealth, material possessions. Well, we make these things our goal. We want to be wealthy, possessed of wealth, because we're dissatisfied with being poor. And in the same way, when we make, say, knowledge our goal, we want to understand, we want to know, add to our knowledge, to accumulate facts, investigate principles. We want to do all this, we want to be all this, we want to be possessed of knowledge, to know, because we're dissatisfied with our present state, that is to say, our state of being ignorant. So this is the pattern, this is the procedure, this is what always happens. We become aware of a certain poverty in ourselves, something missing, something lacking, something absent, and we want to try to gain, to achieve that which is absent, that which is lacking. All this is quite familiar. The process is quite familiar. And in a sense, we can say that on its own level, perfectly right and correct procedure. But unfortunately, it's all extended into the spiritual sphere. Take another example. Suppose I have a problem, a personal problem. Let's say that that problem is the possession of a rather bad temper. I get irritated, I get upset, even angry, rather easily. Even a small thing is enough to spark me off. I see some people looking at other people, but better if we look at ourselves. So the possession of this bad temper, even this persistent irritability, makes me, and makes other people very often, very disturbed, if not actually, from time to time, miserable. So what happens? One fine day, either on our own account or because of what other people tell us, what they bring to our notice, we realize our state. We feel so wretched, so uncomfortable, so miserable. We are so dissatisfied with being like that, that is to say, being bad-tempered, that we think, all right, it's time all this ended. It's time it came to a stop. So what do? We set up, we construct for ourselves a goal. The goal of being good-tempered. We think, well, here I am now, I'm bad-tempered, it's a source of misery to me, I must get rid of it. What must I be? I must be good-tempered. That's my goal. Here I am, a bad-tempered person, I'm going to achieve this goal of being good-tempered, being sweet-tempered, always returning the soft answer, turning the other cheek, and all that sort of thing. So we set up this goal, and we try to reach it, we try to realize it, try to make ourselves, as it were, good-tempered, sweet-tempered. But what usually happens? I'm sure you can all tell me this. We almost always, if not invariably, fail. If we succeed at all, it's only momentarily, just once or twice. We check ourselves, we control ourselves, but before very long, before many days have passed, certainly before many weeks have passed, we are back again in the same old rut. And we usually, of course, blame it onto other people, onto external circumstances. Now, why is this? Why does this happen? Why is it that I'm not able, really, to cure my own bad temper, to become good-tempered? What's the reason for the failure? It's a question which concerns all of us, because we all have problems of this sort. If not the problem of bad-temperedness or irritability, certainly other problems of an analogous nature, so it concerns us all. What's the reason for the failure, the great, even the catastrophic failure? The reason is that all the time we're really unaware of the cause, the reason, the fundamental deep-down cause and reason of our being bad-tempered. And if this isn't resolved, if we don't know why we are bad-tempered, what is making us irritated, what is prompting, really, the angry answer or the violent reaction, we can't possibly hope to become good-tempered. It's not, of course, a question of just intellectual understanding, just knowing objectively, theoretically. It's something much more than this. Now we can extend. We can generalize a little more. We can say that most of our problems, if not all, really boil down to this problem or this question of happiness and unhappiness in one form or another. Even this question of good and bad temper is a question, really, of happiness and unhappiness. Bad temper is a problem for us, or we realize it's a problem, because it makes us miserable. It makes us unhappy. But taking this wider view, this wider perspective, what usually happens? We feel unhappy for some reason or other. We feel miserable, ill at ease, even tormented. Now, we don't really usually ask ourselves why. If we do ask at all why, we ask only superficially. We only skim the surface, and we get, or we give ourselves only, a very superficial answer in terms of symptoms, in terms of externals. What we usually try to do is to escape, to get away from the experience, the feeling of being unhappy, and to be happy. We don't usually ask ourselves, we hardly ever really deeply ask ourselves, why am I unhappy? We simply see, or we feel, or we realize that we're unhappy, that we're miserable, discontented, and we simply ricochet, as it were, or try to ricochet from that state, from that experience, into an opposite state or experience of being happy. And this usually means grasping at some object or some experience which we think, which we believe, will give us the happiness which we lack and which we seek. In other words, what happens is we set up happiness as a goal and we strive to achieve it. We feel unhappy, so we set up this goal of happiness. We try to get away from our feeling, our experience of unhappiness, and to reach the goal of happiness. Now here also, as you know very well, we nearly always fail. After all, our whole lives through, in one way or another, we're in search of happiness. No one is in search of misery, certainly. No one's in search of unhappiness. Everyone is in search of happiness. Everyone sets up happiness as a goal, but everybody fails to reach it. Everybody fails to realize it. There's no one who could possibly say that he's so happy that he couldn't imagine himself being even a little happier. Most people, if they're honest with themselves, they have to admit that their whole life in fact, is one of more or less unease and dissatisfaction, punctuated with little flashes of happiness, joy, which make them temporarily forget, if not their actual misery, at least certainly their discomfort and discontent.